Chapter 71. To a porter, knew that the king was a mere bigoted fool, who would undo himself and the cause he sought to advance. But he was deaf to all reason, and, happily for England ever afterwards, went tumbling off his throne in his own blind way. A spirit began to arise in the country, which the besotted blunderer little expected. He first found it out in the University of Cambridge. Having made a Catholic a dean at Oxford without any opposition, he tried to make a monk a master of arts at Cambridge, which attempt the university resisted, and defeated him. He then went back to his favorite Oxford. On the death of the president of Magdalen College, he commanded that there should be elected to succeed him one Mr. Anthony Farmer, whose only recommendation was that he was of the king's religion. The university plucked up courage at last, and refused. The king substituted another man, and it still refused, resolving to stand by its own election of a Mr. Hawke. The dull tyrant, upon this, punished Mr. Hawke, and 25 more, by causing them to be expelled, and declared incapable of holding any church preferment. Then he proceeded to what he supposed to be his highest step, but to what was, in fact, his last plunge head foremost in his tumble off his throne. He had issued a declaration that there should be no religious tests or penal laws, in order to let in the Catholics more easily, but the Protestant dissenters, unmindful of themselves, had gallantly joined the regular church in opposing it tooth and nail. The king and Father Petre now resolved to have this read, on a certain Sunday, in all the churches, and to order it to be circulated for that purpose by the bishops. The latter took counsel with the Archbishop of Canterbury, who was in disgrace, and they resolved that the declaration should not be read, and that they would petition the king against it. The Archbishop himself wrote out the petition, and 6 bishops went into the king's bedchamber the same night to present it, to his infinite astonishment. Next day was the Sunday fixed for the reading, and it was only read by 200 clergymen out of 10,000. The king resolved against all advice to prosecute the bishops in the court of King's Bench, and within 3 weeks they were summoned before the Privy Council, and committed to the Tower. As the 6 bishops were taken to that dismal place, by water, the people who were assembled in immense numbers fell upon their knees, and wept for them, and prayed for them. When they got to the Tower, the officers and soldiers on guard besought them for their blessing. While they were confined there, the soldiers every day drank to their release with loud shouts. When they were brought up to the court of King's Bench for their trial, which the Attorney General said was for the high offense of censuring the government, and giving their opinion about affairs of state, they were attended by similar multitudes, and surrounded by a throng of noblemen and gentlemen. When the jury went out at 7 o'clock at night, to consider of their verdict, everybody except the king knew that they would rather starve than yield to the king's brewer, who was one of them, and wanted a verdict for his customer. When they came into court next morning, after resisting the brewer all night, and gave a verdict of not guilty, such a shout rose up in Westminster Hall as it had never heard before. And it was passed on among the people away to Temple Bar, and away again to the Tower. It did not pass only to the east, but passed to the west too, until it reached the camp at Hounslow, where the 15,000 soldiers took it up and echoed it. And still, when the dull king, who was then with Lord Feversham, heard the mighty roar, asked in alarm what it was told that it was nothing but the acquittal of the bishops, apostrophe he said, in his dogged way, "Call you that nothing? It is so much the worse for them." Apostrophe, between the petition and the trial, the queen had given birth to a son, which Father Petre rather thought was owing to St. Winifred. But I doubt if St. Winifred had much to do with it as the king's friend, inasmuch as the entirely new prospect of a Catholic successor for both the king's daughters were Protestants, determined the earls of Shrewsbury, D. Danby, and Devonshire, Lord Lumley, the Bishop of London, Admiral Russell, and Colonel Sidney, to invite the Prince of Orange over to England. The royal mole, seeing his danger at last, made, in his fright, many great concessions, besides raising an army of 40,000 men. But the Prince of Orange was not a man for James II to cope with. His preparations were extraordinarily vigorous, and his mind was resolved. For a fortnight after the prince was ready to sail for England, a great wind from the west prevented the departure of his fleet. Even when the wind lulled, and it did sail, it was dispersed by a storm, and was obliged to put back to refit. At last, on the 1st of November, 1688, the Protestant East Wind, as it was long called, began to blow, and on the 3rd, the people of Dover and the people of Calais saw a fleet 20 miles long sailing gallantly by, between the two places. On Monday, the 5th, it anchored at Torbay in Devonshire, and the prince, with a splendid retinue of officers and men, marched into Exeter. But the people in that western part of the country had suffered so much in the bloody assize that they had lost heart. Few people joined him, and he began to think of returning and publishing the invitation he had received from those lords as his justification for having come at all. At this crisis, some of the gentry joined him, the royal army began to falter, an engagement was signed, by which all who set their hand to it declared that they would support one another in defense of the laws and liberties of the three kingdoms, of the Protestant religion, and of the Prince of Orange. From that time, the cause received no check. The greatest towns in England began, one after another, to declare for the prince, and he knew that it was all safe with him when the University of Oxford offered to melt down its plate if he wanted any money. By this time the king was running about in a pitiable way, touching people for the king's evil in one place, reviewing his troops in another, and bleeding from the nose in a third. The young prince was sent to Portsmouth. Father Petter went off like a shot to France, and there was a general and swift dispersal of all the priests and friars. One after another, the king's most important officers and friends deserted him, and went over to the prince. In the night, his daughter Anne fled from Whitehall Palace, and the Bishop of London, who had once been a soldier, rode before her with a drawn sword in his hand, and pistols at his saddle. "God help me," cried the miserable king. "My very children have forsaken me." In his wildness, after debating with such lords as were in London, whether he should or should not call a parliament, and after naming three of them to negotiate with the prince, he resolved to fly to France. He had the little Prince of Wales brought back from Portsmouth, and the child and the queen crossed the river to Lambeth in an open boat, on a miserable wet night, and got safely away. This was on the night of the 9th of December. At 1 o'clock on the morning of the 11th, the king, who had, in the meantime, received a letter from the Prince of Orange, stating his objects, got out of bed, told Lord Northumberland, who lay in his room, not to open the door until the usual hour in the morning, and went down the back stairs the same, I suppose, by which the priest in the wig and gown had come up to his brother, and crossed the river in a small boat, sinking the great seal of England by the way. Horses having been provided, he rode, accompanied by Sir Edward Hales, to Feversham, where he embarked in a custom house hoy. The master of this hoy, wanting more ballast, ran into the Isle of Sheppey to get it, where the fishermen and smugglers crowded about the boat, and informed the king of their suspicions, that he was a hatchet-faced Jesuit. As they took his money, and would not let him go, he told them who he was, and that the Prince of Orange wanted to take his life. And he began to scream for a boat, and then to cry, because he had lost a piece of wood on his ride which he called a fragment of Our Savior's cross. He put himself into the hands of the Lord Lieutenant of the county, and his detention was made known to the Prince of Orange at Windsor, who, only wanting to get rid of him, and not caring where he went, so that he went away, was very much disconcerted that they did not let him go. However, there was nothing for it, but two of them brought back, with some state in the way of lifeguards, to Whitehall. And as soon as he got there, in his infatuation, he heard mass, and sent a Jesuit, to say grace at his public dinner. The people had been thrown into the strangest state of confusion by his flight, and had taken it into their heads, that the Irish part of the army, were going to murder the Protestants. Therefore, they set the bells a-ringing, and lighted watchfires, and burned Catholic chapels, and looked about in all directions for Father Petter and the Jesuits, while the Pope's ambassador was running away in the dress of a footman. They found no Jesuits, but a man, who had once been a frightened witness before Jeffreys in court, saw a swollen, drunken face looking through a window down at Wapping, which he well remembered. The face was in a sailor's dress, but he knew it to be the face of that accursed judge, and he seized him. The people, to their lasting honor, did not tear him to pieces. After knocking him about a little, they took him, in the basest agonies of terror, to the Lord Mayor, who sent him, at his own shrieking petition, to the Tower for safety. There, he died. Their bewilderment continuing, the people now lighted bonfires and made rejoicings, as if they had any reason to be glad to have the king back again. But his stay was very short, for the English guards were removed from Whitehall, Dutch guards were marched up to it, and he was told by one of his late ministers that the prince would enter London next day, and he had better go to Ham. He said, Ham was a cold, damp place, and he would rather go to Rochester. He thought himself very cunning in this, as he meant to escape from Rochester to France. The Prince of Orange and his friends knew that perfectly well, and desired nothing more. So, he went to Gravesend, in his royal barge, attended by certain lords, and watched by Dutch troops, and pitied by the generous people, who were far more forgiving than he had ever been, when they saw him in his humiliation. On the night of the 23rd of December, not even then understanding that everybody wanted to get rid of him, he went out, absurdly, through his Rochester garden, down to the Medway, and got away to France, where he rejoined the Queen. There had been a council in his absence, of the lords, and the authorities of London. When the prince came, on the day after the king's departure, he summoned the lords to meet him, and soon afterwards, all those who had served in any of the parliaments of King Charles II. It was finally resolved by these authorities, that the throne was vacant by the conduct of King James II. That it was inconsistent with the safety and welfare of this Protestant kingdom, to be governed by a Popish prince, that the Prince and Princess of Orange should be king and queen during their lives, and the life of the survivor of them, and that their children should succeed them, if they had any. That if they had none, the Princess Anne and her children should succeed. That if she had none, the heirs of the Prince of Orange should succeed. On the 13th of January, 1689, the prince and princess, sitting on a throne in Whitehall, bound themselves to these conditions. The Protestant religion was established in England, and England's great and glorious revolution was complete. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.